What I thought in arranging was, hoping the idea was that one issue that hadn't come up or had too much attention was the relationship between turbulence driven by convection and differential rotation, specifically in stars like the Sun. So the idea of this lunchtime discussion is that I'll give a very brief introduction, then Yuri will talk about numerical modeling of the interaction between turbulent convection and differential rotation, and then Steve Tobias will go on to talk about the role of differential rotation in the solar dynamo and the fluctuations in differential rotation in the Sun. And we'll try and keep it within an hour or so and not let it drag on all through the afternoon. Certainly not drag on so far that still running. No, I was going to say we'll try and have a break so that Chris can recover and of course start to get sorted at 4 o'clock. But I think we should in fact aim to have it finishing in not much more than an hour on one hand, but on the other hand, I hope we can stimulate discussion, interruption and so forth. And in particular, I know that Axel has some results that are very relevant that he'd like to talk about. But just to remind you of the structure of the Sun, which is relevant to what I'm going to be saying. What we know is that the Sun has an outer convection zone, which is about 200,000 kilometers deep, and below that energy is carried by radiation, and we see the convection of the surface of the Sun, and comparing the Sun with other stars, it's in or near the convection zone that the Sun's magnetic field is generated. So we're talking about the effect of convection in the upper parts of the Sun on differential rotation, given that the Sun is rotating, but not rotating very fast. Well, if the Sun were rotating fast, or if we were talking about a star that had just arrived on the main sequence and might be spinning even 50 to 100 times faster than the Sun, then the effects of the Coriolis force, conservation of angular momentum, would be very strong, and the Taylor-Troutman constraint would lead you to expect that at least the momentum density, or particularly the velocity, would be constant along the line surfaces parallel to the rotation axis, i.e. that you would expect the angular velocity to be constant on cylindrical surfaces in a rapidly rotating star, or at any rate, if you were outside the circumscribing cylinder that imposes the radius of its core, you would expect something like that to be true. And for instance, the most likely, I think, explanation, or most commonly accepted explanation for the banded structure on Jupiter is that it is just caused by cylindrical patterns that intersect the surface of Jupiter at different latitudes. So theoreticians were blithely confident that they knew how the interior of the Sun would rotate until helioseismology came along. And through decoding the frequencies of different modes with different ends for a given L, it was possible to get map angular velocity below the surface of the Sun. I think this is perhaps the greatest achievement of helioseismology, and that it's given results that one could not have got by any other means. And it turns out that there's a zone around the equator. We know from the surface that the equator is rotating more rapidly than the poles, where perhaps you could say there's some such variation as there is, suggests that it might be not bearing too much on cylindrical surfaces. But through the bulk of the convection zone, omega is more or less constant along rate with respect to radial changes, and is a function of latitude or co-latitude only. So the simple statement is that in the convection zone, omega depends on latitude, but not significantly on radius. There's another plot with the same results. You can get the results that come from different measurements from the ground-based GOM network or from space through MDI on SOHO. At different latitudes, this shows the angular velocity, which is a function of radius. The bottom of the convection zone is about there. And to a reasonable approximation, you could say that higher latitudes, much variation with radius, a bit of acceleration near the surface, and then a flattish profile. And then there's an abrupt transition to apparently uniform rotation over a region which looks like that, but is not properly resolved. In fact, all the evidence suggests that this transition occurs over a very small interval in radius called the tachocline, which is something like 2 to 5% of the solar radius. So there's a profile in the convection zone, there's a more or less uniformly rotating core, and a very abrupt change, which has to be explained. So the three problems we want to look at, first of all, this is what Yuri will be talking about, how does turbulent convection generate this pattern? Secondly, what's going on with the tachocline? And thirdly, what about the solar dynamo? And I'll just try to comment briefly on...
Are the results on helioseismology as accurate on the surface as they are in the interior?
At the surface, you can obviously look directly.
But I'm in right below the surface. In other words,
yes.
How accurate is helioseismology as you go down in radius?
As you go down in radius, it gets less and less accurate. Okay. Near the surface, it's extremely precise and accurate. And I guess I should say that the surface measurements, not surprisingly, are in agreement with Doppler measurements.
But perhaps we could distinguish between resolution and accuracy. The accuracy probably doesn't change a great deal, but the ability to resolve with radius or with latitude broadens as you go down.
Yeah.
One of the main measures of inversions.
In some sense, the credibility of structure revealed in a picture like this gets less and less as you move inwards. So clearly you can draw conclusions from that pattern there. But that bit is not clear, and what happens right near the center of the sun is very hard to determine. This sort of structure is reliable.
Is the decrease at the surface due to the drag from the magnetosphere? Or?
Probably due to mixing of angular momentum by convection in the surface layer. So as you go further from the axis of rotation, so it slows down. I don't think it's not due to extraction of angular momentum by the solar wind, because that's a very slow process.
Yeah.
And the convection zone turns over in months.
Okay.
And that's on an evolutionary time scale.
Yeah.
Okay, there are various obvious approaches to describing differential rotation convection. The natural one to attempt nowadays would be numerical modeling, which Yuri has talked about, so I won't say much about that myself, except to say that it is possible with care and caution and suitable adjustment of parameters and boundary conditions, indeed to find simulations with yield profiles that are not too far removed from what's observed. But I don't think one could say that there's a general description available in any sense at this point. The other approach, which is interesting and really, you know, apart from Axel, there's no one here with experience of it, I think, is what I call microdynamics rather than macrodynamics, or by analogy with mean field electrodynamics, but dynamo theory, mean field hydrodynamics, which has been developed at Potsdam by Günter Rüdiger and Richard Henoff, and Axel has been involved in. The idea here is you decompose velocity into mean and fluctuating components, and then you try and find a way of representing the Reynolds stress. One thing you can do is to assume that turbulence in stratified fluids, say, not forget about rotation, is anisotropic. Obviously the vertical direction is different from the two horizontal directions. The R direction is in radial spherical polars is different from the theta and phi directions. So you could introduce a viscosity tensor, which is diagonal but anisotropic, and try and model turbulence in that way. You could then go on to think about what would happen if rotation is included. So the mean velocity would include an azimuthal component, and you'd still have some sort of anisotropic part to it, which would include gradients in angular velocity. But there's also a term proportional to the angular velocity itself, with a third rank tensor they call lambda ijk. And now this tensor now has all diagonal components because of rotation. And the lambda term, the lambda effect, depends on the nature of the turbulence. It's very similar in principle to the alpha effect in mean field electrodynamics. And this approach has been developed. I hope we'll perhaps get some examples later on from Axel to provide interesting results. So it's hard to pin down lambda, showing the difference between slowly and rapidly rotating stars. Slow rotators looking a bit like the heliocyclological profile, rapid rotators being Taylor Pradman mice. So that's something about the first problem. Second problem is the tachocline. I'll just make a few remarks about that. First, to say you look at the results and say, why is the radiative core rotating like a solid body? The answer is everyone who thought about magnetic fields has expected for the last 40 years or something that this would be the case, because the evolution time of the Sun is very long. If there's a small colloidal field in the radiative core and differential rotation, it will be wound up many times, produce a strong toroidal field, and that will then be a couple exerted by the Lorentz force, which will give rise to oscillations, which in complex topology would be damped and would lead to uniform rotation. And the simplest possible calculation is a field of 3 microgauss, which is like an interstellar field acting over 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 years. That would suffice. If you allow for instabilities, probably you need a field of 100 to 1,000 to the gauss. And most people would say that, sure, somehow or other you would expect to be at least 10 to 100 of gauss, even in the radiative core. It's not obvious. The Sun went through its phase when it was fully convective, and if it had an oscillatory dynamo in that case, that would kind of wipe out memory of the magnetic field as the radiative core grew and the convective zone retreated. But certainly, there's every reason to expect more or less solid body rotation in the core, and then a slow spin down through cores conveyed through the convective zone to the radiative zone as the solar wind spins down from the Sun as a whole, starts to hurl. So then you couple the internal part to the convection zone, which is rotating rapidly at the equator and slowly near the poles, and you obviously expect a situation where the core rotates at an intermediate velocity and there's some sort of torques exerted by the outside on the inside in such a manner there's no net torque vocally on the whole system. That means there's a region with strong differential rotation with radius as well as with latitude. That's likely to be unstable. There's been some linear calculations by Pete Gilman and colleagues, and the preliminary nonlinear calculation by Pascal Garrow of Cambridge. That's likely to happen. What form turbulence will take is a bit unclear. It's strongly stratified, which is beneath the convective part. And the simplest picture that Spiegel and Zahn was that because it's stably stratified, there would be two-dimensional turbulence on the potential surfaces, which they said would tend to mix the angular velocity and make omega uniform. On the other hand, meteorological studies tend to indicate that in those circumstances, you take the Earth's atmosphere, think of two-dimensional motion, it's not omega, it's mixed, but the potential vorticity is roughly like the radial component of the total vorticity in the natural frame, and that would still lead to differential rotation. So that's an unclear situation. On top of that, as a result of the central rotation, anyhow, you would expect meridional circulations having that sort of form with two cells in each hemisphere. And in intermediate positions, any magnetic field in radiated zone would be sucked up. Douglas Scott and Mike McIntyre put forward a model in which the crucial effects depend on the presence of this field protruding from the inner core into the Tackett line itself. The oscillating field of the dynamo, which would be out here in this picture for the 22-year period, has such a minute skin depth, highly conducting compared to the sun, probably doesn't significantly that. But this is clearly the region where you would expect, or the top of this is the region where you would expect strong toroidal fields to form. And that leads to dynamos. Quickly finish this. Steve will be taking it up. The basic idea of the dynamo, of course, is you start with a colloidal field, differential rotation, which is clearly going to be principally in the Tackett line, will wind it up and produce a toroidal field. Then in some form or other, cyclonic eddies, whether driven by magnetic buoyancy instabilities or part of the turbulence, will turn that around and produce a reverse toroidal field, and then the cycle proceeds in that way. And in mean field dynamos, that's the Omega effect, that's the alpha effect, represented by the alpha effect. You can take linear models and then kinematic models, and then you get a magnetic instability as you increase these two effects or increase the rotation rate of the star. Imagine it increasing. You eventually have an instability which leads to dynamo action, and in a nonlinear regime, that will be saturated, and the saturation depends on the Lorentz force, J cross B, which is obviously nonlinear. And if you're looking at mean field dynamo theory, that's going to affect that and that, or the process is modeled by those parameters. What we'd like to do, obviously, is to plunge into a grand challenge numerical model of the solar dynamo. But I think the point to stress is that would involve including the effects of the Lorentz force on differential rotation. Until you understand how convection generates differential rotation in the first place, it would be a bit premature to plug in the Lorentz force and do that bit of it without having the main bit triggered anyhow. So at the moment I think it's premature, though we should be thinking of how we would proceed when you're in the trends to solve the differential rotation problem. One way of looking at this, which Steve will talk about, is what I call macrodynamics, talking about a mean magnetic field acting back on the differential rotation through the Lorentz force, which depends on the mean current and the mean magnetic field. And you can see that if each of these varies cyclically with the 22-year period, say, or period P cycle, then will be a component of the Lorentz force, which will have twice the frequency, half the period, an 11-year period, and there's some evidence, observational evidence for that. So that's one saturation procedure. Another approach, which has been followed by the Potsdam people, and again Axel may talk about it, is the microdynamics approach, where instead of talking about the mean fields, you talk about the role of the fluctuating fields, quenching of the alpha effect. Tell me that this was discussed at great length earlier in the program, perhaps you can still hear of it today, but also the lambda effect that I talked about earlier, which changes or can be modeled as changing through the effects of the mean fields rather than the large scale fields. And all I need to say is that there are calculations by Potsdam group which give it instructive results, looking a bit like what I see. Okay, that's my bit. Well, feel free to interrupt, ask questions, but otherwise I think we should proceed and wait for questions at the end.
Or interrupt. Well, I was going to speak about two things. One concerns some of the results concerning heliosismology. Thank you. Handover.
Can't speak until.
Does this actually go anywhere? And will anybody ever listen to it?
From the back, and you'll only listen to it.
I've never listened to it.
Okay.
No, I understand. There's a way. I'd like to talk both about some aspects of heliosismology, and particularly emphasize that in addition to being able to get these impressions of the time-averaged angular velocity of a sun, we're also, just fairly recently, beginning to detect significant variations in the rotation rate. In fact, something near the base of the convection zone that's operating with about a 1.3-year period. And we had something in Science Magazine about a month ago on this. I'd like to show you some directions in which it goes. Then I'd like to end by showing you some of the simulations that we have underway. But I'd like to particularly begin by emphasizing that many of these efforts require a major touch of humility. The issue is that the sun, to many of us, is an interesting object because it's nearby, but it is a testable laboratory for hydrodynamics in many ways, and MHD. And as Nigel said, we have a convection zone that occupies the outer 30% by radius below the surface. We can also really test it, that the solar structure models that would suggest that is the structure are consistent with the helioseismic results. But the big questions in some ways, to many astrophysicists, stars are all solved. You can plunk them down onto these Hirschsprung-Russell diagrams approximately, so what else should you be doing? We should be going on to greater things. And there are many nicer greater things, like large-scale structure of the universe and early galaxy building. But there are still problems with stars, particularly when maybe we know too much about them. And the big problems with this star is, why is it that it exhibits differential rotation? That's a plus point detail. Why does it have a particular structure of angular velocity with radius and with latitude? But particularly, what is the relationship of that angular velocity to the fact that this star has cycles of activity? And it's really the cycles of activity that particularly get our attention and also perhaps NASA and the world, because there may be some link to climatology in ways that are unclear, but may have some relevance. The big problem with trying to deal with an object like the sun is that, as with almost all physical systems, there are a heck of a lot of different scales involved. And it's possible to say, we will model something, but whatever you model, you have to do so with some peril. In particular, near the surface, we see granulation, very intense, fast convection that's about 1,000 kilometers across, or 1 megameter in horizontal size, has lifetimes of the order of 10 minutes, typically. It also has, in the surface layers, we see slightly larger ordering patterns, which have come to be called mesogranules, that are of the order of 5 or 7 of these megameters in size, and lifetimes of maybe 8 to 10 hours or so. And then the supergranulation was found about before mesogranulation and much after granulation. It was really by Bob Noyes and company, who at the same time discovered in detail that the sun was oscillating with so-called 5-minute oscillations. If you filtered these out, you saw there was an underlying velocity pattern, which have come to be called supergranules by them, which are the order of 30 to 50 of these megameters in size compared to this one. And that's a very orderly structure. So it looks like convection, at least in the surface layers, manifests three scales. They may be discrete, they certainly look discrete, but their spectrum may overlap. And further, you have the 5-minute oscillations more or less thundering away, and they extend from circle 9 degrees 0 to about 3,000. And some of them have a very high Q. They're very resonant cavity. They may change their phase only over several hundred oscillations. Now, the trouble with most physical systems, including the solar convection zone, is that if you ask, well, how many dynamical scales might it have active? Well, it's probably somewhere of the order of 10 to the 18 spatial modes. How do we determine that? Well, the depth of the convection zone is of the order of 100 megameters. It's really 200, but dimensionally, so we're 10 to the 5 kilometers, there will be some scales that respond to that. And then probably the smallest scales are of the order of 100 meters or maybe less, which is our photon beam fate paths by which the diffusive mechanisms begin to operate with some bending. So we have in any dimension of the order of 10 to the 6 in scale. And if you're playing a three-dimensional world, it's 10 to the 18. That's a rough. Now, does it mean that all of these are independent players? Probably not. Some of the groups may be slaved because of preferential driving and other things. But any one of these stars is a fairly serious piece of business. And our hero simulations now, however they're done in whatever geometry, they're of the order of 1,000 cubed. And the biggest hero ones where somebody gives you their whole machine are now are of the order of 4,000 cubed, but it's only a stunt because you can't really do many calculations yet. But if you have to evolve a piece of dynamics, this is kind of where we are. So there is a certain amount of sea room between 10 to the 18 and 10 to the 9, but that's why we're in astrophysics, I guess. The interesting thing is that this granulation, the sort of the smallest scales here, is also the thing that ends up, badly tilted, sorry, I moved the projection to be out of the way of the other machine. The granulation is also the thing that contributes to the fact that the sun is oscillating. And if we zoom in on the smaller scales on the sun, here's a close-up view from the ground, about as best as we can do, and this is 1 megameter, 1,000 kilometers. And here's an intensity image. The interesting thing is the motions in the surface layers are very fast. The sound speed there is about 7 kilometers per second, and the typical velocities in this granulation are the order of 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers per second. And so then it's fairly difficult to separate out in its compressible motion between what is sound and what is motion. But these things make lots of sound. And that's why he uses seismologies in business, because in this superficial surface layer, there are a whole bunch of sound makers going on all the time. The convection zone has the property that you can carry the flux of the sun near the bottom of the convection zone by very leisurely motions, 50 meters per second, and a temperature fluctuation of 1 Kelvin out of 2 million, or 1 million Kelvin. So it's a very small perturbation will carry the solar flux. It isn't much. In the surface layer, you've got to be really moving along. You're moving at 1,000 meters per second and 1,000 Kelvin, partly because of the heat capacity has dropped so severely. And it's this stuff that makes the sound. And that stuff makes it possible, maybe with a slightly larger perspective view. This is a sort of a piece of the quiet sun, but these are the megameter scales. There are larger scale patterns that are present in here. This happens to be in a particular bandhead that responds to what we think are effectively effects of magnetic fields in networks, which you see as these little bright points. There are multiple scales present. Now, the oscillation stories are complicated. They're fundamentally simple because we can capture most of the stories about the oscillations of the sun using spherical harmonic functions and linear theory. The individual amplitudes of the pulsations that are present are very small. Linear theory does fairly well. You can even do fairly well with even adiabatic treatments. But the main issue is that you describe what a mode is, or one of these pulsation modes, in terms of three quantum numbers, something about its radial order, something about its spherical harmonic degree L, and then the orientation of that in the system, the azimuthal order. So LM, N, L, and M are the three quantum numbers, and associated with one of these modes is a frequency. It's an eigenvector problem in a way. But on the other hand, you can orient these patterns somewhat differently, and what we call the Feynman oscillations are in fact about 10 million different modes that are operating, and they have certain resonant cavities, all of which share the property. This is a cross-section cut across the sun with radius. The convection zone occupies the outer 30% below the surface. Is that they have a fair amount of wiggly structure from there. They all share an upper reflection point just below the surface, largely because the medium is beginning to change very rapidly, and a broad range of waves are reflected there. They head back inwards again. And there's an internal refraction that occurs because the sound speed increases monotonically with depth. Surface is 5,000 Kelvin approximately, 16 million here. Sound speed goes like the square root of temperature. So you tend to steer sound waves around. So any given mode looks a little bit wiggly like this. Some are with high degree are confined to just the surface regions, others throughout a very large fraction of it. And so how could you measure anything with these darn things? Well, any given mode won't do much for you, because its frequency or period is essentially an estimate of the sound travel time from here to the lower reflection point. And you can be operating various sort of overtones in it. So it just gives you an average of the sound speed across that cavity. Not interesting. One number, what do you do with it? Not much. But if you had access to very many different modes with different sampling positions in radius and also in latitude, then the same way that we can build localized delta functions or something that looks like a localized function out of a lot of wiggly functions by, say, Fourier construction, you can do that also effectively by inverse theory. So that you have to have an idea of what the structures may be for the modes, but then you can confine them and build it. And it's really by by paths like this that we got to the things that Nigel was showing. A given mode, for instance, just because it looks pretty in terms of its structure, but for L equal to 40, N equal to 36, and N equal to 12, this is sort of the world space occupied by one mode. And we have about 10 million of them. So they have a certain depth range, they have a certain orientation. They're all running waves. There can be ones that are propagating east and others propagating west. And we can use the fact that they're east and west propagating modes to be able to look for apparent frequency splittings that by observing it as a sort of a stationary observer compared to waves that are running, we may find that certain waves that are kind of going against the stream have their frequency changed compared to those that are with the stream. And so rotation, for instance, breaks the symmetry of the frequencies, gives you a frequency splitting, and that's the main path by which we can begin to detect something about, for instance, the integral of the angular velocity with depth. We can also do so with sound speed, quite a few other things. But it is out of these efforts that we've gotten to the point of where we have a medley of different pictures, and one has to be fairly careful to sort of ask what are the consequences of different inversions carried out. Here's the equator, here's the pole. We're looking at inversions from data from a spacecraft that's at the L1 Lagrangian point between the Earth and the Sun called SOHO, sort of a Hubble-class spacecraft, essentially, and has a major heliocosmology experiment on that. The other project is GONG, that's a network of observatories around the world. Using the SOHO data, we have another look at essentially how the angular velocity varies with depth, and it's very much like what Nigel was saying, of course, that there's a distinctive change of angular velocity. The coding is here. We tend to use these frequency splittings like engineers in terms of nanohertz. A typical rotation rate for the sun is of the order of 25 days or so, and that's 450 nanohertz. So this is down here is slow rotation, low frequency. And you see, of course, that we're fast near the equator and slow near the poles, and approximately constant on radial lines at mid-latitudes. There's some alignment with the rotation axis here. The different inversion techniques give you slightly different impressions at high latitudes because they tend to use the data in somewhat different ways, and it becomes kind of an issue of good taste, what to believe or not believe, or how you both try to refine your resolution at the expense of amplifying the noise. And geophysicists have called these essentially sort of trade-offs, criteria or procedures. The main thing is that we get pictures of in some cuts like this. I'm sorry, this one doesn't have labels, but this is a cut of the angular velocity at the equator at 15 degrees, 30 degrees, 45 degrees, and 60 degrees. And the two lines refer to different inversions carried out in different data sets. At lower latitudes, there's good agreement that there is a region of rapid change in the base of the convection zone and nearly uniform rotation inside. At high latitudes, there's some diversity of opinion. But we understand how they probably come about. That's the sort of view of what the sun would look like based on averaging over a year or 2 years of data. On the other hand, what we've also learned in the last year is that if you, for instance, were to take cuts at the equator from the inversion, and this is a little bit confusing, but here is the primary inversion result, and then another inversion carried out and shifted 72 days later, time advances down here. What it begins to emphasize is there appear to be changes both in this region near the Taffet line, the base of the convection zone shown by this dashed line, and also in the bulk of the convection zone. Now, the question is this a property of some errors in the data and our handling of it, or is the sun actually exhibiting some changes in angular velocity? And we've done a fair amount of sort of searching on that. The behavior shows us differently at different latitudes. This is at 45 degrees, the former was at the equator. But in particular, we've concentrated on looking for behavior in this region of the Taffet climb where we think the dynamo might be operating, and so the greatest emphasis has been there. And what we've found, essentially, is that if we look at the variations from the angular velocity that's based on a multi-year average, like a four-year average, as a function of time, if we look for departures of that rotation rate as a function of time, carried out two places, one near the base of the convection zone, 0.72R, convection zone is 0.71, where at least the gradients change, and then within the radiative interior at 0.63R, and then looked at departures, these are again these Annenberg's quantities, 450 is the typical rotation rate. We're seeing variations from two different data sets and two different ways of inversion that seem to indicate a wobble. And I'd like to particularly concentrate on these two panels that are both at the equator. This is the equator, 30 degrees and high latitudes. Over from the time that the gong instruments were turned on, and then Soho joined it, and now. And what we particularly have found is, in this accentuated view, that there seems to be a slowdown, speed up and slowdown, with when you analyze this approximately 1.3-year period. And further, this panel is above the Taffet climb, this is below the Taffet climb. And interestingly, it looks like there's an anti-correlation between the speed up here and the slowdown here. Now, we've gone only through about four of these cycles, and they're not clean cycles, but sort of periodogram type of analysis shows that most of the power is around 1.3 years. Is this of any significance? Well, if the average rotation rate is 450, then a dynamical range of say, 6 nanohertz isn't that impressive. On the other hand, the contrast across the Taffet line in this location is about 30 nanohertz. If viewed in that terms, then this is about 20% variation. And these are the first indications, and I think they're fairly robust. A whole crew of us had worked on it intensively with different techniques that suggested we're probably detecting speed ups and slowdowns in the low latitude regions of the sun, in the region where we think that perhaps the dynamo is operating. Now, what is the cause of it, and what do you make of this 1.3 year period? Well, we were in some ways delighted because we're all scientifically a little bit ignorant, but we got an email from Mr. Richardson at MIT who said, wow, a couple of years ago published a paper saying we see 1.3-year periods in the sun as seen in the high-speed wind stream from two spacecraft, Voyager 2 and the IMP-8 in the near-Earth orbit. And their analysis, quite independently, was 1.3 years. And they pointed out also that in sort of 500-year records of auroral sightings, there, for certain intervals, a substantial period of about 1.4, 1.3 years comes and goes. And so, of course, the next question, I said, fine, what does it look like now? Well, in the area which actually overlaps with where we're running, the signal has partly gone away, or largely away. Now, the high-speed wind stream from the sun is fairly geometrically complex because it comes probably out of the coronal holes that are in the high-latitude regions, and you have certain sectoral structures in the high-speed wind stream, and it made there really issues of alignment with that stream. But perhaps from things near the base of the convection zone, we're also influencing things that are in the external field of the sun. I mean, most of us think that probably is the likelihood.
What is the effect of the diffusion? For instance, it takes a lot of time for this box to go if it's generated at the base of the condition?
Well, if you release it, if it somehow chooses to pop up, it's up in about 12 days or so. I mean, it's a very buoyant character, or 20 days, something comparable to the overturning time. If it were by diffusion alone, it could take its half a million years or so. But if you somehow build these strong belts of magnetic field near the base, and if somebody says, okay, kid, on your way, or if there's an instability that drives it off, then they move fairly rapidly. And so there's been a fair amount of work done to study the rise of structures that you declare to be essentially flux ropes, and they come up pretty fast. Now, I'd like to talk about some of the things we've been attempting to do to look at rotating spherical shuttles.
Maybe it's appropriate now to ask this question, what the cause of the signal could be. I mean, I've discussed this with you briefly. Could you maybe repeat again why you think this 1.3-year signal cannot be related to the structure of turbulence, the signal of the turbulence, and that shorter time intervals cannot be seen because of duration?
Oh, it could be lots of things. I mean, we're sensing something near the base of the convection zone. And also in what was often thought to be a much quieter region of the radiative interior. The mixing or the sloshing that is occurring doesn't violate our problem with lithium. We're just kind of at the edge. We're at the point where we would like to have a little bit of burning and to maybe keep the helium from entirely settling out. We don't know what this causes. I mean, I think there's a lot of dynamical variation possible within convection zones, particularly with substantial penetrative events that could go into this region of shear or contribute to making this shear. It's a continuum game. Nobody has any particular prediction that there should be a strong signal of anything. The interesting thing is that the signals that we're seeing are of the order much shorter than the cycle period, and we've also been only looking for a little while. But we're now getting to almost the sort of the active phases of the sun.
B again.
Pardon?
What is B again?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is above the, this is at 0.72 in radius, this is at 0.63 in radius. And just lined up so you can see the timing of it. And it's both data from Gong and SOI with two different inversion techniques. And they largely are tracking, not meticulously, but within their error bars are certainly tracking.
The signal is the largest at the equator.
Yes.
You don't see it at high latitudes.
We don't see that signal at high latitudes. At high latitudes, we see a signal that has much more period of, it's a larger signal, but this is the high latitude signal. At 60 degrees and 75 degrees, we can't distinguish between them. The range there is about 12 nanohertz rather than 6 peak to peak, and the dominant component is close to a year.
So I guess what I'm asking, where's the angular momentum? So if you sum these up, you can measure the angular momentum of the shell quite well, I presume.
Well, within the resolution of these, yeah. These oscillators are essentially, it could be locally preserved if the speed up above the tachocline and below the tachocline are out of phase, that you're almost conserving angular momentum in that.
So your claim would be the data support better angular momentum transport in the radial direction than in the theta direction?
Probably. We can't distinguish between it. But you seem to have one oscillator running at low latitudes, and if there's another oscillator, it's running reasonably independently at high latitudes. I mean, whether they're oscillators, the question is how do you excite them, what drives them? I mean, you could play the game of saying, fine, what's the magnetic coupling between these layers, work out essentially your outlink period for that. Well, let me just spend a few minutes on what we've been attempting to do with rotating spherical shells. There's been a fair amount of work by a number of us on taking localized patches of convection on the sun, local area models, where you get to the point of being able to resolve compact structures and finding that turbulence does have intense or vorticity structures and coherent structures present in it. Here we sought to go to dealing with a full spherical shell, but with some major simplifications. We've essentially bulldozed off the areas near the surface where granulation, mesogranulation, supergranulation is occurring, because we can't resolve them if we want to deal with these calculations and the full domains. We can almost do the supergranules. But we have a code that is three-dimensional. It's anelastic in the sense you filtered out the sound waves but kept the other effects of compressibility present. It uses certain harmonic functions for its horizontal decomposition, Chebyshev polynomials in the radial direction. So it's really a shell builder. We've been able to take calculations up to some up to certain harmonic degree about 500, but the things I'll show you here are up to about 320, and with some periodicity introduced for the movies that are being shown. But basically, the spatial resolution here is about tenfold better than in progenitor studies, particularly early work done by Gary Glatzmar and Peter Gilman. It's a very simplified description. Basically, a perfect gas is assumed within the shell, but otherwise, we're solving things very close to the Navier-Stokes equations. But there are also some many transport terms brought in. But there are systems where the density contrast across these shells is 10 or 20 or 30, so the compressibility is a major role. So we're capturing sort of a big piece of the shell, but not all of it. There's some, just very briefly, some technical issues. If you want to make progress with at these scales with the currents of technology, you've got to build machines or codes that work efficiently on massively parallel machines. We've done so. We can run on most things, but it's fairly complex, as one might expect, of how the codes are structured. But they scale very well, and so they offer a path by which we think we can go forward. I've learned which buttons to push. Here's a snapshot from a solution that is in a more laminar class, and here are shown three views at three depth layers within this system of the radial velocity, near the top, in the middle, deeper down in that shell. And they have a characteristic appearance of banana cells, which are really a consequence of Taylor-Proudman, when it shouldn't apply, but it still applies. The ghost of Taylor-Proudman is always present, where there's a substantial alignment near the equator of the convection cells themselves. And they have certain consequences on how transport is achieved. As you choose to effectively crank up or reduce the diffusivities in these systems, so you increase the Rayleigh numbers, or the driving and the Reynolds numbers, the patterns get more squiggly, and they begin to have properties of strong downflow sites. And when it comes to the issue of redistribution of angular momentum, it is the presence of fairly compact, longer-lived structures that have a very significant role in how the Reynolds stress organization occurs. Let me turn on this playing machine.
What are the typical Prandtl numbers for these?
The typical Reynolds numbers?
Prandtl
numbers. Well, Prandtl numbers were running about a 10. Can I just kill these drop lights for a second? If we go into a co-moving frame with about the angular velocity of the sun and then look at motions relative to that, we're in that viewing frame. We're looking at radial velocity near the top of a zone in a particular calculation. What it emphasizes is that the presence of rotation and convection drives differential rotation. And that is the main effect of this sort of faster moving of these somewhat banana-like cells or aligned structures at the low latitudes, and then a reverse flow up here. So this is your prograde, retrograde differential rotation. The waves, the cells themselves can be moving relative to that differential rotation. They're not just sort of tied into it, but these exhibit sort of a substantial differential rotation across this shell. Excuse me if I just buzz through a little bit of this. Random numbers, for the most part. Not for every calculation, because it's too, but no particular bias.
But it's not fully, is it fully turbulent in the beginning or not?
No, we may take some sort of adiabatic stratification to turn it on. It starts, there are long relaxation times in these systems. That if you wish to redistribute the angular momentum, you're operating some sort of a flywheel, and you might have to follow it for 20, 30, 40 rotation times. Here is the time average angular velocity that went along with that previous solution. It's an average former of about 15 rotation times. And the coding is kind of, as we've trained you now, fast and slow. And approximately, there are some variations that are more radially organized than in straight lines. On the other hand, these are the instantaneous angular velocities. Again, angular velocity is as average in longitude and shown, and they're very big changes at any given time. The region where we think the tachycon should be occurring is here. We do have a stable region inside. We're not building a tachycon. I think our systems are basically too viscous still, that if you wait long enough, they'll pull things along.
What's the boundary condition at the bottom? No stress, is it? No tangential stress.
It's no tangential stress. Here's another sequence where we've gone to essentially stratified degree of about 400, and it's a more nonlinear system by just having reduced the diffusivities. I'll just finish in a minute, Nigel. But it emphasizes that there's much more appearance of sort of cyclonic structures. It drives a fairly comparable differential rotation, but where our resolution has permitted us to get flows that are bordering on sort of turbulent motions. Still, turbulence with humility, because the sun knows how to do it rather better. The system runs fairly substantial differential rotation. It's about 30% from what it does in the equatorial regions compared to the poles. And just a bit of a zoom in, just so we can kind of look at some of the structures. We're also traveling in this frame with approximately with where these cells are. And we're looping back a little bit on the simulation, just because we didn't pull frames out that many. If we were to zoom in, for instance, and there are different structures both at low latitudes and high latitudes, partly because the rotation vector and local gravity are different angles. You know, we're this way here with the rotation vector, and we're really aligned with the gravity near the polar regions. And we would expect that there would be probably rather different changes of behavior at approximately the latitude where the tangent to the inner sphere effectively intersects the outer. And generally, that is seen. But if we zoom in from the top, it again accentuates that you have lots of cyclonic vorticity dominating.
And if you look into the vortex,
yes,
deep down, is there a strong variation of velocity or vorticity or not?
Not a great deal. These are downflows. Yes. They get narrower. But they also entrain quite a bit, which keeps them broader than they might be if they had no substantial entrainment. But there are the downflow systems really penetrate through much of the convective layer, so there are large scale ordering certainly present. And the differential rotation of these things drive is very similar to the one before. I'll just stop for a second.
In those pictures, you don't show the poles. Why is that?
Oh, the averaging, you tend to have fairly large variations in the polar regions. There's a lot of sloshing.
Sure, they're numerically okay, I guess.
They're numerically, they're fine.
So you could actually show them?
We could, but we just have, particularly in the instantaneous ones, the largest variations are here just because there's almost no mass to your
range. What about reality? I mean, I'm sure actually maybe see that in reality as well, that there's a strong correlation to poles.
Well, we have, with heliosismology, we don't have very good ways of asking that question.
No, but the kernels can actually see the surface, but of course not the pole, really.
Well, some of the inversion kernels do go into those regions. Let me get to that in a second. Well, I'm sorry, I'm too long in the tooth. But a reasonably sort of representative model of the angular velocities that come out of these systems are of that class. Some have broken symmetry, some do not. Some time average one over a long simulation. they make some contact with the heliocyclic ones in terms of the contrast that you can achieve in angular velocity. That for a while was a problem, but we haven't been able to yet deal well enough with the issues of attack of time. There is a stable region in here, but these previous simulations were basically too viscous. We're working on that intensively. I agree with Nigel that I think before one were to attempt to create global models of the dynamo, you have to somehow come to grips with what are the issues of sort of variation and structure that you can achieve just with convection by itself. But I think in the next few years that maybe won't be quelled, but it'll certainly be dealt with. Thank you.
I think with time going on, we should ask Steve to continue, and then we can loosen up for the discussion later.
Okay, I don't want to keep anybody from that up, so I'm going to be very quick. Okay, so having established what the differential rotation may look like in the sun from here to technology,
what... I think you want to be saying the only kind of important necessity.
What we may be interested in now is to see how stable that differential rotation is to the effect of adding a magnetic field. And obviously the differential rotation is very important for solar dynamo action. I'm going to go very briefly over the first two components that I have, because a lot of it's been said before. So the differential rotation and the convection zone, there's this combination of turbulence and rotation. Reynolds stresses lead to transport of angular momentum, and hopefully if you get to large enough turbulent values, the differential rotation will be constant on radii, not on cylinders. It appears to be solid body in the radiated core, and I think the best explanation for this is due to the presence of a weak colloidal field, as Nigel said, and this could be a relic field, as Leon and Nigel said in their 1987 paper.
They are a relic field?
Well, I don't know about field. No comment, no. It's certainly relic. I shouldn't say that, but my ex-supervisor. Anyway, will kill me. Okay, so then how do you match these two together? Well, it's a thin layer of shear, everybody's described as the tachycline, which matches the solid body rotation to the differential rotation in the convection zone. And one of the fundamental problems of building tachyclines is what stops the tachycline from spreading inwards into the radiative interior, and there's been a couple of suggestions as to how this may occur. One is due to an anisotropic viscosity, which is due to a shear or an MHD instability, which enables you to have 2D turbulence, which stops the tachycline, the differential rotation, from spreading inwards, and this was suggested by Spiegel and Zahn. But I think possibly a more convincing argument is that magnetic stresses within both the radiative interior and also in the tachycline itself can also stop the tachycline from spreading inwards, and that was proposed by these two groups independently. But I don't particularly want to talk about that today. So we have a basic state, if you like, of differential rotation. What I'm interested in is fluctuations about this basic state. Oh, this didn't come out of the book. Okay. As Yuri said, there's a 1.3-year oscillation in the tachycline. What causes this? I'm not going to say anything about that either, because I only just learned about it. So. But what is interesting is that there are torsional oscillations, so-called torsional oscillations, which I actually thought Yuri may mention, but he didn't, so thankfully I brought a picture of him. What do I mean by torsional oscillations? This is from the paper of Howard and Labonte. If you have a look at fluctuations in the surface velocity on the sun, you can see the prograde and retrograde fluctuations which propagate towards the equator from higher latitudes. You can see these oscillations. Dark is prograde, I think, and white is retrograde. And these torsional waves, I think it's probably a better word for them, have an 11-year period. So this rings the bell straight away, because the solar cycle has an 11-year period. Do these velocity fluctuations...
Well, solar activity has an 11-year period.
Okay, yeah. Solar activity has an 11-year period. the velocity fluctuations are visible at the solid surface, but some recent results of Yuri et al. Helioseismology shows that these continue down to lower radii. But eventually the signal is lost, and that's an interesting question as to why the signal is lost, but maybe it's too much noise from, say, large-scale convection. So what causes these torsional oscillations, this 11-year period? Because the magnetic field has a 22-year period, the obvious thing to say is that there are responses to the magnetic field. The Lorentz force term is quadratic in B, so if you have a magnetic field B, which looks like e to the I omega t, and omega is roughly 11 years, then your Lorentz force term will have a period of 11 years, and then that acting back on the velocity will cause these fluctuations within an 11-year period. So the question is twofold. One is, it's obvious that differential rotation, or it's obvious to those people who work in dynamo theory all the time, perhaps not strictly, differential rotation is very important for the dynamo, because differential rotation enables you to generate very large toroidal fields from colloidal fields. The rotation stretches out colloidal fields into toroidal fields. And the question you could ask is, what is the role of this dynamo-generated field in modifying the differential rotation that caused that? In the first place. Now, most of the work that's been done on the solar dynamo has involved using what's called mean field theory. So I'm not going to get into mean field theory very much. Nigel's got something about it. But what this involves is splitting up the magnetic field into a mean and fluctuating part and the velocity field into a mean and fluctuating part. You then derive an equation for the mean magnetic field, and you see you get the texture term, which looks like the average of the fluctuating components multiplied together. And then an ANSAT is to relate this term back to the mean field, and then substitute back into the equation, and you get the famous alpha effect and the increased turbulence diffusivity. And so you end up with this, with the mean field induction equation, where you have a contribution from the differential rotation producing magnetic field. This is the famous alpha effect term, and you also get an enhanced diffusivity. Now, I like to think of it this way around because I work in dynamo theory, but obviously you can do the same thing with the momentum equation, and that's something people do. If you want to have a look at the effects of magnetic fields, effects of magnetic fields on velocity fluctuations, then you can do a similar approach, and this has been done by the Potsdam group, as Nigel said. So you take your momentum equation, split it up into mean and fluctuating parts. You then derive an equation for the mean momentum, and you see there's the usual sorts of terms. An important term is this Reynolds stress term that Nigel talks about, which comes from an average of the correlation between the small scale velocities. There are two magnetic terms which enter into this equation. This one, which I've done in red, comes from, if you have a large-scale magnetic field, then this will drive a flow by the Lorentz force. Nigel also alluded to this. And this is the thing I'm going to concentrate on today. This is a macro dynamic effect. You simply have a large-scale field driving a large-scale flow. There's another term here which people very rarely look at, and this is the magnetic correlation tensor from the averaging over the small-scale magnetic fields. That's something people don't tend to look at. And there's also, as I've put down here, an effect. If you wrote down the companion equation to this for rho mu I prime, i.e. the small-scale fluctuations in the momentum, you can see that the magnetic field will act back by a b bar b prime term on the u prime equation. And so the field will act back on u prime, and then that will in turn enter back in from this Reynolds stress term. And this has often been modelled as lambda quenching of this lambda effect that Nigel talked about earlier. And Rudiger and Kitchener have done lots of work on that.
Is it obvious that it quenches lambda? As opposed to amplifying?
I don't think it's obvious, but it does. Yeah. It's the result of very complicated calculations to find out exactly how these things work. Now, which of these terms is more important, this lambda quenching or this mean magnetic field? Well, there are arguments either way. This would be very important if you had a strong mean field, or I should say mean field, where your turbulence is generated, this lambda quenching term. So, i.e., if you have a strong mean field in the convection zone, you expect modification of the turbulence by the mean magnetic field to be very important. But solar dynamo models tend to, and I've talked about this before, so I don't really understand, they saw the mean field away. They saw it in the tachocline. And so it's natural to look at just the straightforward effect of, you know, you have a large scale field with a period of 22 years in the tachocline. What is its effect in driving a large scale velocity field? Well, what you could do is you could impose an oscillating magnetic field and just look at the stability of the differential rotation profile to an oscillating magnetic field, just arbitrarily imposed. But it seems more natural and sensible to derive your magnetic field from a dynamo, even if a mean field dynamo, whether you believe it or not. And so what you can do is you couple the mean field dynamo equations to equations for the mean velocity fluctuations. So your dynamo model is going to give you your oscillating magnetic field that you want to have a look at the stability of the differential rotation to, and then you self-consistently generate a velocity fluctuation, then you plug that velocity fluctuation back in to your differential rotation picture and hope to get a self-consistent picture that way. And this has been done by numerous authors. Malthus and Proctor were the first people to do this in a sort of geodynamo calculation. And for that reason, this is often called the Malthus-Proctor mechanism. Although if Mike Proctor was here, I certainly wouldn't call it that. I'd probably call it the Malthus mechanism. And I did some work on doing this on an interface dynamo model where the current paradigm for dynamo action is that the magnetic field is generated in the tachocline, and this requires you to use one of these interface dynamo models. So what we're interested in is investigating the role of these driven velocity fluctuations in A, saturating the dynamo, and B, once you've saturated the dynamo, the velocity fluctuations come back into the differential rotation that will modulate the basic cycle. Now let me just show you the equations very quickly. This is an axisymmetric mean field model, for those of you who don't know what it is, where you write the velocity field, a vector potential for the colloidal field and a toroidal field, and then we impose this velocity field V as coming from the differential rotation, and what we want to calculate self-consistently is the fluctuations to the differential rotation. The important parameters are the dynamo number, which is a measure of the driving, and this parameter tor here. So you can derive equations for A, B, and V, and this parameter here, tor, represents the ratio of the diffusivities for the magnetic field to the diffusivity for the velocity fluctuations.
Flattened out the spherical model.
Yeah, well, okay, I'll say it now. I was going to say it in a minute. Okay, this...
what do you mean by derive?
Sorry?
What do you mean by derive equations?
Derive equations.
What does it mean, derive?
Oh, okay, you take the mean field equations that I presented before.
What does random studies, what do you do to them?
Oh, okay.
Sometimes they're positive, sometimes they're negative, sometimes they...
These are equations for the mean. So what you do is you parameterize the effects of the small scales in both the alpha effect term and in the mean velocity equation. You parameterize them, and you only write down equations for the mean fields. So this is a weakness of mean field modeling, in that you only...
So basically the small scales and
the small scales have disappeared.
Alpha effects.
Only alpha effects, yeah, and in generating the differential rotation that you start with. Now I'm going to impose that differential rotation. I'm going to say somehow it's come from one of Urey's simulations or whatever,
okay,
because of the small scale. Yeah. Now I'm looking at the fluctuations, which are driven by the magnetic field. Yeah, it's very important to realise that in these mean field models there are a lot of parameters to play around with, and that this is a weakness of the field. But it does enable you to play around with parameters, which is good. So as I say, two important parameters are the dynamo number, which is a measure of the driving of the dynamo. So as you increase the modulus of the dynamo number, you increase either the strength of the alpha effect or the strength of the differential rotation. But as we're holding the differential rotation fixed, we can think of this as increasing the strength of the alpha effect. And the other important parameter is tau, which is, as I have described it here, the turbulent kinematic viscosity of the turbulent resistivity. And so you can think of that as the timescale of viscous transport, the timescale for turbulent magnetic transport. Okay, well, I'm going to go very, very rapidly through these results. The first thing that you encounter as you increase the dynamo number is an oscillatory, a periodic solution for the magnetic field. So this is equivalent to your 11-year cycle. So I could have just imposed this and had a look at the fluctuations driven by this, but it seems more natural to generate them self-consistently. So I now have an oscillating magnetic field, which looks something like this. This is my periodic solution. So I get dynamo waves of activity migrating from middle latitudes to the equator. And this is my basic state, which is going to drive the velocity fluctuations. At this point, I should put up what happens in the real sun, I guess. In the real sun? In the sun. Okay, so this is obviously the motivation for the whole thing. What we're interested in explaining is the butterfly diagram, the 11-year magnetic field. 22-year magnetic cycle and the 11-year activity cycle where sunspots appear in pairs and migrate from middle latitudes to the equator. If I just impose that as an oscillating field, then it may not be quite as interesting. But you see, already this is now driving some fluctuations in the velocity. And this fluctuation is periodic, and in fact obviously it has a period of half the period of the magnetic cycle. Now as you increase the driving...
So numerically, what is the value of it then you put in the solar parameters?
Okay, as I said before, this is a mean field model, so I have a lot of parameters to play around with. So I can get this at 11 years, if you like, but that's only because I choose the parameters, so you have to be a bit careful. But what I cannot do, or what I... Okay, I'll come back to this in a minute. As you increase the driving further, let me just show you what happens. This periodic solution loses stability in what's called a secondary hot bifurcation. So this is, if you like, the 11-year cycle. It wiggling up and down here. And that drives a velocity field, which acts back on the magnetic field and produces this modulation. Now this modulation cycle, Tn, I can't a priori impose, so that just comes out to the model. But I do have another parameter to play around, so I can move this around. So what's happened is that this oscillatory solution has gone unstable. If you like, the original differential rotation with a weak periodic fluctuation about it has gone unstable to a new state where the velocity fluctuates on a much longer time scale, and that in turn acts back on the magnetic field and makes that what's called a quasi-periodic or modulated solution.
The benefit of astronomers, quasi-periodicity in mathematics means something quite different from quasi-periodicity in looking at.
Okay, what I mean by quasi-periodic here is that it has two well-defined frequencies, a frequency of modulation and a frequency to do with the basic cycle. So I'll just summarize. What's happened, so as the forcing is increased, an oscillatory dynamo sets in, and this field drives something which resembles the torsional oscillations with twice the frequency. I'll show you some pictures in a minute. Then what happens is that this oscillatory state destabilizes, and that's due to this velocity fluctuation that you've driven. And you get a modulated response. As I said, I have this other parameter, tor, which is mu t over e to t. And it seems that the time scale of modulation scales with this other parameter as tor to the minus half. And the system acts in a way which is very similar to a relaxation oscillator. In fact, you get changes in magnetic field which drives changes in the differential rotation on a very slow, on a slower time scale, because I choose tor to be small here, and that leads, that then acts back on the magnetic field and leads to this modulation.
If you said that the diffusivity is actually equal to zero. Would there be this driving? Does this driving depend on some sort of phase lag?
Well, there would still be the driving of the velocity. I mean, the driving comes from the Lorentz force term.
Right.
The question is, what is the response of the velocity to the magnetic perturbation? And that is controlled by the turbulent viscosity, you see.
Okay.
Yeah, so there is the phase lag.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You can get similar results just by arbitrarily putting in phase lengths in the system.
Right, that's right. Yoshinura in the 70s had a dynamo model where he arbitrarily imposed phase lengths and got similar sorts of modulation. So, in this way, it's the viscosity which acts as a natural phase length. So, what's interesting is that if the turbulent resistivity is much larger than the turbulent kinematic viscosity, that velocity fluctuations can drive modulation on very long timescales. And you may say, well, why may we be interested in that? Well, if you do have a look at the 11-year cycle and sunspot numbers going back to the 1600s, this is where we are today. You can see a nice regular 11-year activity cycle, but you see that this activity cycle is modulated on a much longer timescale. And indeed, in the 17th century, there were very few sunspots observed. And this is not an observational effect, this is really there were very few sunspots. And so it seems that the sun undergoes periods of modulation, and indeed chaotic modulation, and recurrent grand minima. We know that these minima happen as you go further back in time, not from direct observations, but from proxy records such as beryllium 10 and carbon 14. Beryllium 10, which is found in ice cores, and carbon 14 in trees. This may be an explanation for why you get this sort of modulation. As I said, as you increase the driving, you can get more and more esoteric solutions. These are very nice, simple solutions, where waves propagate towards the equator. This is a very interesting solution where you have a dipolar solution. Because of the fluctuations that you've driven in differential rotation, it enters one of these, which I like to call Maunder minimum phase, relating back to the thing. So there's very sunspots. But as it emerges from the Maunder minimum phase, you get a solution which looks like a quadrupole solution. So this may be an indication that just because the sun is dipolar now, it could have been quadrupolar. As my brief is to talk about fluctuations in velocity rather than magnetic fields, I should show you some of these torsional oscillations of periodic dynamo waves. So the torsional oscillations of the periodic dynamos, what I'm plotting here is the equivalent of a butterfly diagram, or the diagram I showed you earlier. So this is latitude against time, and you see what's happening is the magnetic field are driving velocity perturbations which migrate towards the equator. On an 11-year timescale rather than on a 22-year. So my conclusions is that everything's quite complicated. to really understand the solar dynamo, you have to understand this whole whole picture, I would say. You need to understand how turbulence interacts with differential with rotation to give you the differential rotation in the first place. This turbulence, I should have another arrow in here, combined with the differential rotation will lead to the generation of a magnetic field. Then this magnetic field can then do two things. It can act back on the turbulence via the Lorentz force term, which I didn't talk about. Or it can drive large-scale velocity fluctuations, which in turn act back on the differential rotation and may cause modulation. What I'd like to point out here is that this effect, which I haven't modelled at all, the effect of the magnetic field and turbulence, may be important for other stars, where the mean fields and the turbulence are distributed, rather than this interface dynamo model picture. So, finally, some interesting other aspects that people are working on at the minute as to where as to the stability of differential rotation profiles. As Nigel said, there's some work done on the interaction of magnetic fields with differential rotation instabilities. Peter Gilman and Peter Fox have done some work on that. What we're interested in now is, myself and David Hughes, are the interaction of magnetic fields with shear instabilities. Shear instabilities are very well understood in hydrodynamic literature, but they're less well understood when you add magnetic fields, so we've been doing some work on that. And down here, people are interested in the interaction of shear with magnetic point instabilities. All these may lead to instabilities of the differential rotation. And Greg Howes and Steve Cowley are also working on a similar problem where they look at the interactions of fields and shear on the convective instability, which again may be important for the base of the solid convection set in modifying differential rotation. And maybe one of these instabilities has a period of 1.3 years, which would explain Urey's results, which would be very nice. So, I hope I can catch up on your lunch as well. Thanks.
What are we doing with that? How long could we conceivably go on?
Another 2 minutes.
No, it's 10 minutes.
No, it's 22.
When you're having fun, it really passes.
I guess people were responding to that question.
Yeah, I think we should probably stop.
Does
Axel, do you want to
say? I have
two
transparencies which are related to
the
Lambda effect.
Why don't you show this?
Yeah.
You can start with the people
who initiate the informal discussion, they can do it then. That's the related to what has been brought up today. And on the other hand, it's related to work that I've done in the past. The first thing is a low-resolution convective shell calculation, so it's a low-resolution 3.5 times supercritical only, and this was a calculation which Michel Letoy had available. It has a rather, it's a rather thick shell because he was modeling the Earth. Anyway, we have a differential rotation in this convective shell, very much like Urey has in his high resolution and also much more convective turbulent calculations. But you see that the differential rotation does increase towards the equator. Now the question is, how is that related to the Lambda effect? Nigel mentioned the Lambda effect. The Lambda effect is an additional contribution to the stress, and the overall stress has some V0 on the boundaries. Now, if there's an extra stress, present, that means the original rotation is no longer a solution, and then a differential rotation is the corresponding to the solution for the stress-free requirement. And that means the extra contribution can be related to the Lambda effect, which has different theta dependencies that can be related to Lambda 1, Lambda 2, Lambda 5, and so forth. They all have different depth dependencies. We have used those calculations to measure the Reynolds stress, which is shown over here. That's the Reynolds stress theta, a Q theta phi. So it's positive in the northern hemisphere, it's negative in the southern hemisphere. We measured that. We then obtained all the coefficients. Then, now the interesting point, which actually tells us that it actually works, is we plug that back into a real model. It's a two-dimensional model of the shell. We plug in these coefficients, and that's what we get. And so you see there is a fair agreement between the two models. This is more cylinder-like than the actual simulation is, but otherwise you will cover a number of similar features here. So that's the first point I wanted to make. Lambda is a quantity that you can actually measure in terms of the stress, and you can put that back into a model and calculate the corresponding differential rotation, which should then be the same. Now, first of all, the question is, why is that good? The answer is, if you have a mean field model, it allows you, if you can rely on that, it allows you to make extrapolations. So that's the general value of mean field theory. So you must have a means of calculating actually these transport coefficients. And there's one way of doing that from local models. I want to show you here one picture. This is a calculation by Polkin and company where we've calculated the stress in localized models of convection. And the and so this is for the southern hemisphere, and again you see that the stress is negative in the southern hemisphere, and we basically have the same profile that we had before. So this is to be compared with this one. In those two cases, you recover then a similar profile on the southern hemisphere.
So you take your box and you move it to different latitudes.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And it's amazing that that actually works. It's not a priori clear, but this is a proof that it actually works, I think. Then the other thing is, there's this problem with the Taylor-Pullman theorem, which tells us essentially that the differential rotation has to be independent of z. If you take the momentum equation, the following terms, there's essentially a centrifugal term written here in a non-rotating frame of reference. The pressure gradient can be decomposed into an enthalpy gradient and an entropy gradient, and it's only this term that matters. So if entropy does not matter, then of course this term is absent here in the current momentum equation, and so this must be zero. The only way that you can relax this, and the most plausible one, is by having actually a significant contribution to this one. Now, how can we get that? Down here's a model, which we had in number two already, and the idea is the following. The heat transport equation, basically the heat is covered mostly by a convective flux, but the convective heat transport must be anisotropic because rotation makes turbulence anisotropic. And generally, you can write such a tensor chi ij for the diffusivity in terms of in this form where you have some coefficient and 1 minus omega I omega j. That's the general way how rotation, rigid rotation, affects transport coefficients. So it lowers the transport along the pole. And near the poles. So if you have less transport along the pole, that means the heat must be higher at the pole. There's less of a coefficient in front of this one here, and therefore the entropy gradient must be much less here. And that means the pole is somewhat hotter, not a whole lot. In our models, it's hotter by 10 to the minus 5 only. And once you have that, you have this temperature gradient which points inwards in this direction. You have an entropy gradient which points forwards. That gives a positive contribution, and because you have two plus signs here on the two sides, this must therefore mean this one must be negative. And that's of course exactly what happens. Omega now decrease, has a slight tendency, still not very strong, but a tendency to decrease towards the pole as we go along there. One thing I should point out also is in order to measure such a heat excess, it's not correct to measure along geometrical surfaces, but you have to measure along surfaces of constant potential, isopotential surfaces. Because in this case, because the sun is rotating, the isopotential surfaces are elongated. We have taken this into account. Otherwise, we would get a much larger coefficient, 10 to the minus 3 or 4 or something. So that's the main thing. One thing to finalize is on the same table we had also a magnetic effect, so there's a magnetic modulation also on the differential rotation. As Yuri is saying, there's a strong modulation
of omega very much at the poles. Here, this is the dynamo solution. So that affects the differential rotation. And it affects also the entropy, of course, as a function of time, and it leads to variations in the thermal luminosity. So once this mean field stuff is getting more accurate, and there is a, in principle, a way of doing this by using local models, we can go ahead and make better predictions. And I think one of the things, one of the areas where this can hopefully go into would be to understand the packet line, where we have a vast separation of time scales, and that is very difficult to do in real simulations. That's what I wanted to contribute.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. We should probably break up now. If anyone wants to raise further issues, feel free to
do it. Around.
You have strong radio.
We have to share the
component. We've also had the simulation. I was wondering if you just thought about comparing the results of the convection.
Understanding of how the turbulence.
But that's really good.
Those are reasonless. what would be the roles, what are the effects of the round stress in terms of compared to meridional circulations and balance of sensitive, and they're all concerned.
So the point is, I mean, your basic point is that the Coulomb differential pressure gradient is larger as you play it instead of the pole.
Get slow shadows. Slower pairs. We've been largely exploring the different temperatures, so
there has to be a larger pressure gradient.
I'm keenly interested in what happens in
system. Like having an extra pressure.
It's faster.
I see what it means.
What happens with core connection, core dynamics.
Yeah, I see what it means.
Much faster with the general game bit.
So you have to go rotating more rapidly.
So I think there must be quite
a family of possibilities. So in your models, as Alex had mentioned, you have lots of, I guess it's
smaller radial pressure.
He was doing
smaller radial pressure.
So your simulations, you must know exactly how many dimensional parameters.
The main effects are
How can you make those effective viscosities and their functional forms?
I guess I don't understand what the argument is.
As you transition from laminar to turbulent, scale gets this jump emerges, these structures that are fairly long lived between the temporary structures. And I think natural systems do that also. What you must have operating is affected in an inverse cascade.
Probably because the
put an energy a certain way down, then there's
one time maybe
the cascaders then leads to
printing or using more of it. It's just efficiently up and down.
That is certainly emerged from
down the axis.
It's a series of different types of things.
But the conventional
with rotation without rotation.
And
the full tilt calculation is really at the point where we're a good enough resolution that we're just beginning to touch those current structures. Way to go.
Temperature is
larger than
the pole. That probably you're still trying to represent the turbulence.
These will come forth at times. We can describe some of it by putting a random entropy into those layers.
Right.
Yeah, no, we're computational observers.
Okay.
But it's crucial to have some idea of what the questions are, what are the tests that you're carrying. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I think some of the things that may emerge from this are assessments of what are the effective lambdas or their functional forms, mm-hmm. which paths are important. There are other effects that are present. It isn't simply the slide that's shown here. The fact that you have a weak mineral circulation, which we can see with the image quality very well. There's from the equator polars is a movement of about 10 to 20 meters per second. The sun's been operating two cells, northward and southward, and then last year they broke the symmetry, so the northern system is now two cells.
Oh, before there was one cell?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And we can track that down about sort of 30% into the convection zone for. These are using local views, global ones, just in the sense of the we have our mineral circulations are about the same amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes single cells shift into multiple cells. But in things like Earth, these mineral circulations carry a very large fraction of the entire heat transport from the equator. It pulls half in the ocean, half in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And they're comparable redistribution length of the minimum occurs. So the heat stress plus the thing, I hope that the sort of astrophysical turbulence also sort of manifests into healing to some of other objects on the in sequence. I think the wondrous ones that are called making stars are basically untouched by anybody in a serious way. But why is it that certain A-type stars, with their core convection, the whole occupies about the other 25% of our rotors? The so-called slow rotators are the ones that often exhibit magnetism, and magnetism of the bending of an entire continent to 3,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
But slow rotators are ones that are rotating less than about 100 kilometers per second. Scaled to the sun would be 4 kilometers per second.
Mm-hmm.
The breakup velocity of the stars is about 280 kilometers. Rapid rotators, not as much magnetism. Slow rotators are the ones with magnetism. But it's a lovely subject because the certainly convective cores, as well as your very region, maybe doesn't make much difference. If you look at mixing models of that stuff in there, its convective properties are very much like the invasive convections. The motions are of the order of 10, 20 meters per second,
mm-hmm.
and one kilo to carry. Overturning time is about a month. But these stars rotate in half a day or a day or 2 days. So the rotational constraints are very interesting. The code that we have could be used for that. We want to probably work on this kind of approach. But I think this is more, it's an untouched subject. I think it would be, again, fascinating to work on these things, partly learn about technologies. And the A-type stars have lots of nice technologies.
Yeah. Well, I think people, I was talking to, what's his name, at Yale.
Mark.
And he is also, he's actually directly simulating the convection. I guess he was one of the in the surface layers.
Right.
And was.
But he's interested in the long term evolution of why you might cause a star.
Exactly. But what he was able to do was to show that at least the models then parameterize the convection using his simulations and showed that he claimed that it's like the subject Newton zone is definitely out the window. But using his results that he was getting from convection that induced by going to a solar rotator. So then I asked him, could he then apply this to other stars? And he said no. But that is, because there's no order of magnitude theory, he's done, he put in all the solar parameters and kind of listed what the sun does. But you can't generalize. The only way he can generalize other stars would be actually with a systematically start when you work through them.
But he particularly worked with number of other colleagues on sort of the evolutionary history of the sun, potential.
Right.
So you can get to that. And his mixing it as it is, you know, today's sun is very much like everybody else's. There are no, when you're thinking of tutorial cumulus,
I was just talking to him earlier this spring, and he was saying that now this is not mixing like model that you
said. Well, he isn't strictly, he has he has equations for where you seek to describe how you're losing the momentum. And so, the two-dimensional R and theta models, but a great deal is parameterized in that.
Right, well, that may be what he's doing. So it's just by using these simulations, he can then fix the value of these parameters.
Right.
And those then, you know, can do a very good job on the sign of this stuff. But he doesn't know how the parameters change. And he was saying, one thing I wanted to ask you about, is he was saying that took him the longest to do his simulations was actually getting, allowing his models to relax to get by thermal structure.
Yeah.
So that's it. Do you have to worry about that too?
Well, yes. So we have to start from thermal structures that are semi-sensible compared to what we think the structure models are. So we start from stratifications like that. But even then, the biggest problem is the flux is so small compared to the thermal capacity of that shell that you're working on. Mm-hmm. So that if you have yourself too hot a sun, that would have been in the years or something. So it's really the Kelvin times come in.
Right.
Those are fairly long.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was because it appears that trying to understand the tactic time is crucial. What are the prospects that the helioseismology in the next 5 years will be able to resolve that much better for us?
I don't think it's very hopeful, largely because we use in global modes. And we know what the wind structure of the characters will get in there. And so effectively, the inversion resolution, for direct inversion resolution, is about 4 or 5% in radius, which is our sampling modes. You can play the games with doing constrained models, and you say, let me assume there's a jump, and then is the data consistent with my model? Mm-hmm. That's a side of thinking. So a fair amount of that has been done, but the outcome is a little bit more than I hoped. But where there
are many, why is it that your further thought that your resolution is limited if you're for those modes, but if you go to higher modes, you get higher resolution?
Well, the higher modes start don't go that deep.
Oh, I see.
So it's a combination of the starting line degree and the radial order.
Right.
And the number of modes that actually get down to there are sort of essentially about L of 30, 40 and lower. And the others have a turning point above that, so nobody touches it. There are also uncertainties, what do we do? All of these modes have their upper reflection point where there's a lot of junk. Mm-hmm. And we've had certain ways of dealing with that junk. When we say that we can get an agreement between say mode frequencies and what we observe to better than 1%, that is already taken off a certain fraction, which is kind of an offset, which we think is attributed to what to do with the reflection properties there. We're learning, we'll continue to learn how that reflection property is modulated as a function of time using very high degree models. And I think the improvements will be in then being able to refine what we do with the corrections of the surface reflection. Reflection properties. Mm-hmm. That I think will also, since that property is shared by also the ones that sample the static line, I think that'll be one.
So I guess another question I could ask is even if you have a slight sub-pixel imaging, as you get better and better signal noise, you can see stuff at less than 1 pixel.
Yeah. We're playing that game, but not too much. Mm-hmm. You're still having if you're really good at what you do, then the sampling kernels are perhaps looking something like this and have wiggles.
Right.
This may be the depth to which you're trying to aim this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have outriggers. And so if the sun conspires to have fairly complex velocities in those regions, you're still convolving the data with this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't be able to thinner.
Mm-hmm.
What we can do is to study some of the temporal variations that we've seen, which we've been looking at pretty intensively.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we've placed clear credence on something that looks like a repetitive phenomena or looks like something that is being transported as a wave, to say that mm-hmm. we believe that more than the wiggles. And having independent data sets is that's actually also very crucial.
Mm-hmm.
the other path that works is that if you could look to some simultaneously from several vantage points, and this is kind of the spirit of some of the stereo missions, then you could do the ray bounce directly, and we follow this time distance method. Tom Duval, Jack Harvey, and others have worked on them intensively. So that's a local GPS seismic technique that you really look at correlation functions over great distances. So there are rays that will get you into the tactical plane, but you need to be on the back side of the sun or quite far removed from it to be able to see it. Mm-hmm. So that if with the current vantage point where we can look at things just here, and it's really correlating what has happened to certain rays, have they gone? With these techniques, we're now getting in up to about 100 megameters, but not even. But if you have a little vantage point, then you could probably play the game. I mean, technically, you could play the game if something doesn't have too much noise in the very best. But I think there's been a real revolution in terms of both in several of these senior seismic techniques. There are also anti-nodal points that if you, for instance, had something go off on the backside of the sun, it would have a certain signature where the antipodes would be on the foreside. Mm-hmm. And that's been used to try to post-factor detect certain magnetic structures on the backside before they've arrived. Mm-hmm. And it's Doug Brown, Charlie Lindsay had a paper in Science about 2 months ago from that. Mm-hmm. Looked like it has promise.
Okay. So this then is the best hope to really try to get more data like that.
Right. Yeah. Because you need things, you still have the fundamental property that a damn wave has got to get to somewhere.
Right.
And if it doesn't get to there, it's not sending anything. Exactly. It's always an integral over. Mm-hmm. And so that tells you where the bounce is. Mm-hmm. It also helps a lot to very quiet data sets. So the space vantage point is easier in that way. GOM has been working very well. We're going to higher resolution detectors, at least. Originally we were running 256 squared as a detector system. Sun has a lot of power out there, we're still aliasing some stuff back. So we're now going to 1,000 squared detectors. That was in the lead of GOM Plus, and the GOM Plus Plus, we could actually use all the data through the fourth, which requires another medium term. We're doing half-hour processing on the subwoofer for now. But I think it's the subject basically very much alive. Unfortunately, the sun is kind enough to actually show signals that are of interest as opposed to saying, we'll just keep getting more and more data and getting a better and better definition of a mode frequency. But of course, if the sun is changing in the meantime, you're missing that part. Mm-hmm. So our deep snapshots involve taking about 2 months of data and then running it along.
Can I ask another question? In your simulations of the tachycline region, are there any impulsive events that occur there? Because that would be another way to try to actually see the effects of, if you were imagine building up the field, if there were any events that occurred quickly, which would then have some effect on the surface.
Well, I would think that we don't know if they do. Mm-hmm. But they're likely to. If you have configuration instabilities that perhaps then lead to some of your torrential flux rivers being sent on their way, which they seem to do, then there should be accompanying signatures on that.
But you might be able to see that.
We might be able to see it. Well, the simulations could be run that way. Mm-hmm. Right now they're facing a hydrodynamic simulation.
That's right.
The codes themselves have torrential flow. Presentations for fields we haven't really running on. The main thing is if the sun chooses to put most of its beginning fields in essentially fiber fields in these intense ropes, then our resolution for the beginning structure probably needs to be 10 times better than that of the persisting of the in such structures. Therefore, we haven't played any of that seriously. But the parallel machines have proved to be much better than they certainly looked at in the beginning, but they're really ragged machines to use.
So how much acceleration do you get per processor compared to using, because these are serial processors, so I don't know, parallel machines. Yeah, but previously we were using power convection processors, so.
But of course the world has gone too fast. The Japanese are still investing in the fastest sort of processors you can buy in. And so they're getting on the order of 2 or 3 gigaflops out of a processor. That's a $1 million processor, $2 million processor. So Fujitsu and NEC. Practically all the processors we have right now, you can get sort of 1/5 of a gigaflop per processor. But if you've got the things well enough organized, then it's a simple scaling factor.
Yeah.
So we've had codes running at a sustained 150 gigaflops on a 500 kilo potential machine. You don't usually get that. But I think the financial scaling is certainly very much better for that path. There are issues, of course, of real pains because you may have to maybe data transfer on a local nature, and that the timing and the pre fetching and all of that.
No, we're just getting into the layer place just then. We're in the process of trying to
do that. I think since our cultural investments are all in these machines, we've got to figure it out. But you're doing basically fully compressible calculations.
That's right.
So there are local in that sense. Mm-hmm. I work a lot with Paul Winters on PPM kind of things. Yeah. That's, of course, the great blessing of compressible ones. You don't have to do a global solve, maybe for gravity, but not for pressure.
Exactly.
But these, we're running here on elastic codes, but there's a sound wave and other things. They're global solves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're right. The gravity is all the less than stuff.
And then with gravity at all.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. Well, we are. We're not running it with optimum efficiency at the present. But we do it with multi-rate solve, which is
efficient. Right.
Then we're in the process now also trying to put in some transfer. Mm-hmm. Because what we really want to be able to do is imagine the cloud is collapsing down to actually determine whether or not it's going to fragment. Right now we're just stuck in an equation of state which gets different.
Right. But
that's obviously this 4% precision. And the interesting thing is it turns out it's very difficult to make the binary strong. I mean, pretty all structured binaries. We just throw something on the computer and try to make binaries. And we found out Frank Schutte is a very nice piece of work recently in which he and his colleagues analyze the stability of many distributions, for instance, things that were rotating very rapidly and so forth, and show that they generally did not have all binaries. So that if you start off with many initial conditions that you might think of to make binaries, you don't. And that.
What do they make?
They.
Many or one?
Well, no, they will just make one, and then they will send, you know, the disk or send a minimum amount of, you know, two particles level. They don't break up into two. So interesting enough, it turns out the turbulence appears to be the key there. All his work is based on assuming that you have, you know, some axisymmetric distribution of mass and consider various rotations and so on.
But if it's something much more
on the other hand, once it's lumpy, then you can, in fact, and we do find that you can't get more than one star. You're stuck on the fact that we're not you know, running parallel yet. And we're using this adaptive mesh refinement. We're not taking advantage of the fact that you can have the time steps also adapted. We're using the fine time step. Which slows us down by a lot. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping to come out with
it. Was so great fun.
Yeah, right.
I've enjoyed studying it. Older David Porter, Dickie pushed. And I've been telling him for a long time what your code should be run for, and obviously I love a red giant, because with PPM, you pay for the fact that you're compressible, you better have convection, might as well have convection closest to sonic or LC. So I told him that the idea that they really should get to deal with red giants. David said, you'd like to put a star into a great Cartesian grid, have the star find where it should be. That started to work very nicely almost 2 years ago. to provide, you have spreads of order 400, 500 cubes, mm-hmm. and some equation of state. But he breaks big to get the bomb open, and then he cuts off the center and disapplies the flux. But these objects hold themselves together quite nicely. But it also allows, and the motions are close to sonic, just by amount of gravity. But again, that's a very interesting path, and which is a follow coupling between our standard oscillation, the six second variable, and the release, which is like the And sometimes there really is an advantage of not going into very complex type of grids, because you pay a big price for that. AMR helps maybe in some places, but sometimes simple grids, and a lot of them, let you win by.
Well, AMR does you a simple grid, that's an advantage. It's all rectangular grids.
Sure.
It helps in cases like in these turbulent simulations that people like either. They would help a lot because they find that they have only shots from it. So then
when we're not doing that,
people would have a lot of zones there, they have to have their zones everywhere.
That's right, and then barely result in shots.
Yeah.
I was back to that calculation for a while. You arrange it so some stuff is back and you don't confuse it, and you have maybe a waste of security or nothing is occurring. Then the star finds its own sort of shape and features.
Now, did that physics tend to get the wind comes off the star?
They could do that, but it's still semi rough. But at least it illustrates how, partly by heavy silicon, you can make possibly very interesting progress.
I completely agree with you. I think, because I got into this through collaborating with Richard Klein about a decade ago, and at that time, my feeling was that if you looked at a lot of the simulations, that if you looked at a problem, there were some things you could sort of get on the back of them, but that is kind of. Particularly, more, this is, I think, more from astrophysics and solar physics, much more felt tightly to the data than in astrophysics, nearly who knows what. And so you get the basic result that you could look at and say, well, you know, I could have figured this out using a simple twiddle. But then, of course, there'll always be the thing that you couldn't have twiddled or that you didn't expect. And then the question is that thing that you didn't expect, is that physical or numerical artifact? And I think, until not that long ago, you really couldn't tell. And in many cases, those things turned out to be numerical obstacles. Whereas now, I think that we're at a stage where we have a much higher confidence in tracking the same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's a great support to
them. Right. But then, as I say, you're stuck just trying to understand what it means in simpler, back of the envelope terms.
Oh, but you have to have sort of things working in parallel. I mean, these are just computer portals, and you have to have a way of characterizing.
Yeah.
No, it's a nice time to be alive. I started computing when machines had 12 registers.
Right.